So if someone wants to improve their diet for migraine, I think one of the important first steps is to accept that there is no perfect diet for migraine and kind of, you know, let that go from the start. And I think you can set yourself up for success with the understanding that there are things we can do that probably will help you feel better. Some of it will maybe migraine, some of it may be other things like how your gut feels. And so, you know, but not expecting perfection in either, you know, the foods we eat or in the outcomes. I don't think diet can cure migraine, and I don't think we should be thinking that way. But we can think about how diet can improve how we feel in terms of migraine and more broadly.
Food can feel like both a friend and a foe for people with migraine. Over the years, we've heard countless opinions about what to eat, what to avoid, and which supplements might help. But what does the science actually say? To help us separate fact from fiction and discover realistic ways to use diet as part of migraine management, we're joined by Associate Professor Margaret Slavin, a registered dietitian and researcher who has studied the relationship between nutrition and migraine. Dr. Slavin, welcome back to the Migraine World Summit.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Why do you think food and migraine generate so much confusion and contradictory advice?
I think because the evidence is heterogeneous, meaning there's lots of different study designs, lots of different types of foods, nutrients being studied. We look at studies of the whole diet versus supplements isolated and individual nutrients. And it's a lot of information to try to parse and then layer that on top of the complexity of migraine, which folks here are probably familiar with, that it's a difficult thing to study and kind of distill down information into, you know, actionable things that we can do, you know, within our lives. So if I could give an example of why it's so hard to study diet and why we don't have more consistent evidence, I like to talk about randomized controlled trials, which is considered this gold standard of how we investigate treatments. And it allows us to recruit a group of participants, randomly assign them to receive either the intervention or the control condition. And then at the end of the study, if we see a difference between groups, we can say it was due to that difference in the intervention. And this works very well for drugs and pharmaceuticals because it's easy to blind people to the pill that they're taking or even an injection or whatever it might be. And it works to some extent with diet studies, but there are a lot of challenges to that design that are difficult to implement in diet studies. And even when it can be done, it's labor intensive. If we're doing one of these really thorough diets for, you know, 12 weeks or longer, providing most of their foods for a really controlled condition, that takes a lot of time on the part of the research team, the participant as well. You know, even just getting the food and consuming can be taxing for that period of time. So it's hard to do. It takes a long time. It's expensive. And so we don't have nearly as many of those randomized controlled trials as I would like. And I think a lot of people would like to have as well. So we then sometimes we'll take a reductionist approach and we'll look at maybe an isolated nutrient in a dietary supplement. We want to understand if it's magnesium or riboflavin or something, any of these nutrients that if we can just increase the intake of that through a supplement, provide a placebo and study that. And that's a meaningful, meaningful type of research as well. But in terms of the nutrition space, we know the B vitamins are interdependent for their metabolism. Magnesium works vitamin D and, you know, so many other things. And so it really isolates one nutrient and doesn't necessarily account for kind of the broader spectrum of nutritional status that could influence nutrient metabolism.
So we know the research into diets and migraine is very difficult, to say the least. How has the research evolved in recent years? Are we getting better evidence overall?
for the first time, I'm excited to see some longitudinal population research done in the Danish birth cohort study published recently, but on a birth cohort where they had nutritional information about the mom and they followed up when the offspring were 20 years old, looking at risk of headache and frequent headache. And so they were able to draw some conclusions about nutritional intake of mom during pregnancy and headache outcomes, as well as in the kids themselves when earlier in their life, when they were kind of adolescents versus when they're risk of migraine when they're 20. So that I think is a really good advancement for us to be moving in the direction of longitudinal dietary intake and migraine studies.
Let's talk about a couple of different diets. And perhaps we could start with the ketogenic diet, since it comes up often in the migraine community.
Okay.
What does the evidence show so far, and who might it be most suitable for?
So the ketogenic diet, first, for anyone who doesn't know, is a pattern of eating that is very, very low in carbohydrates, kind of moderate in protein and high in fat, to make up for the energy needs. And what it does in the body, in keeping carbohydrate content very low, it almost mimics a fasting state, where the body does not have access to kind of the high levels of glucose to power what would otherwise normally be used for energy metabolism in the body. And so instead, the body metabolizes fats to this alternate source of energy that cells in the body can use instead of glucose. And there are some tissues like the brain, which use primarily glucose for energy. And so when that supply is gone, the brain during a ketogenic diet kind of switches to this alternate fuel source of the ketones. And so the evidence for migraine is there are, at this point, a few clinical trials using different forms of the ketogenic diet. So the other question of who is likely to benefit from the ketogenic diet would be typically people who have probably a little more of severe migraine, or migraine is impacting their life more so, because the diet, you might imagine, is a very big shift for a lot of people compared to how kind of we would typically eat, especially in Western society. Carbohydrates make up the bulk of our energy intake for a lot of people. And so to cut it down is a dramatic change.
What about exogenous ketone supplementation with BHB? Can you break that question down into plain language and then respond?
I'll try. So exogenous ketones is something that's under investigation in the hopes of that might allow us to achieve the kind of benefits to migraine that we see with the ketogenic diet without having to do the kind of very restrictive eating pattern that it takes to put the body into ketosis. And so beta-hydroxybutyrate is one of the ketones that is produced in the body during that state of ketosis. Some folks have been doing some research to investigate if we give that orally as a supplement, would that enable people to reap the benefits of having ketones in their bloodstream? And there is some early research, I would say, to indicate that it looks like at least some people might benefit from this.
Let's shift now to the omega-3, omega-6 pattern. There's exciting research on diets that are high in omega-3 and low in omega-6 fats. What did those studies show, and how might someone translate that into their actual eating habits?
There are really two kind of large, good, well-designed studies investigating the ratio, a diet that controls the ratio of omega-3 fats to omega-6 fats. One of the studies was in people with chronic daily headache, another in people with migraine. Both of them shared reductions in headache or migraine on the diet that is high in omega-3 and low in omega-6 fatty acids. And so what does that mean? How does that translate to out here in you know, those of us making decisions of what to have for dinner. So omega-6 fats are the ones that we tend to encounter more in the food supply. So vegetable oils, corn oil, soybean oil, sunflower oil, safflower oil are a lot of the common ones that have relatively high proportions of omega-6 in them. So they're not only in those oils and when we cook with them, but in a lot of processed foods. Those types of oils tend to be what is used in processed foods, especially soybean oil. And so a diet that is low in omega-6 is not only avoiding those foods or those oils, but also often avoiding processed foods because of their content. Omega-3, I want to be very specific. The diet patterns that were studied in these two trials used omega-3 in fish especially. So that refers to these longer chain fats of omega-3 fats. And this is in contrast to there are omega-3s found in plant-based sources like walnuts.
You don't have to take it in all at once. You can return to extended interviews at your own pace with the All Access Pass. So talking about the next diet, we are also hearing more about low glycemic diets and stable blood sugar levels for migraine. What's the rationale here and how can people apply that principle day to day?
When it comes to low glycemic diets, the rationale is tied into kind of the overall understanding of migraine pathophysiology and who is characteristics of people with migraine. And so there's this kind of prevailing understanding that maintenance of homeostasis or kind of keeping steady habits, steady lifestyle seems to be beneficial for people with migraine. So sleeping consistently, staying hydrated consistently, exercising consistently, and so forth. And so within that is a theory of, you know, if we keep blood glucose levels consistent, and so we don't get these extremes of high blood glucose after a meal with lots of carbs and simple sugars, and we don't get the extremes of low blood glucose from crashing after eating something like that. And so it maintains this sort of metabolic stability, maintains a consistent energy supply to the brain with kind of these consistent blood glucose levels. And the rationale is that that will lead to kind of less triggering of migraine attacks. The low glycemic diet, what it looks like in practice is choosing foods that have more complex carbohydrates. And what I mean by that is foods that still have carbohydrates. We're not trying to avoid them with a low glycemic diet, but choosing ones that are higher in fiber, higher in starch, and less sugar, less simple sugar in the food.
What about gluten? What are your thoughts on gluten?
Gluten, certainly there are some people with celiac disease, and there's a higher incidence of that, of celiac disease with migraine. And so certainly for them, you know, absolutely reducing gluten in, or not eliminating gluten intake would be the treatment for that. And some people, when they do that, if they have migraine and celiac disease, some people see a benefit to their migraines, but not all when they cut out gluten. For others, it's less clear. I think what is clear is that there are some people who are sensitive to gluten. So it's not an allergy, but there's some sensitivity, whether through GI symptoms or even kind of more diffuse symptoms throughout the body when they eat gluten, that they have sensitivity. It's a challenge to diagnose and to identify. And so, and unfortunately, I don't have better kind of practical guidance at this point.
What about dairy?
Dairy? I don't have a lot of evidence to draw on for migraine specifically in terms of studies. I know kind of more generally, there have been a number of studies looking at dairy and kind of broad inflammation in the body. And the more recent research seems to show that it's it does not produce inflammation in the way that prior work had shown. So I think that is fine to incorporate into a healthy eating pattern for people with migraine.
What's your opinion about whole food, plant-based diets?
So whole food, plant-based diets, when I think of that, I think of eating a lot of vegetables, fruits, beans, nuts, seeds. Whole food would mean whole grains. And so there's sort of broad evidence in the nutrition sphere that can be a very healthy way of eating. It's kind of in accordance with a lot of the recommendations or a lot of the kind of eating patterns that we see to broadly promote health, like the Mediterranean diet I would put in that category, which also would include some fish and olive oil and some meat, some cheese, but not excessive amounts. And so, broadly speaking, yes, I do think it can be a very healthy way of eating for people. Kind of and when I say healthy, I mean in the ability to reduce risk of multiple chronic diseases, cardiovascular disease, diabetes, overweight, and obesity, and things like that.
The average person with migraine doesn't necessarily have the perfect diet. None of us do all the time. But what does that mean? But does that mean we need to take supplements? And what's your view?
So first, I would say there is no such thing as a perfect diet. And I think we can let ourselves off the hook a little and stop trying to do perfect. But there are many different ways to get to a healthy diet that take different shapes for different people. In terms of do we need to take supplements, it depends, person to person.
I've read somewhere that 50% of women with migraine are deficient in magnesium.
Yes, we do see very high rates of magnesium deficiency in the population, especially in the U.S. and in kind of Western styles of eating, where we're not eating high amounts of whole grains, beans, nuts, and seeds, and leafy greens. So in that case, taking a magnesium supplement is one way to try to make up for some shortfall in that nutrient. But that doesn't mean it's the only option. There are dietary factors that people could attempt to change their diet.
So magnesium is only one supplement. There's others as well. I mean, we've spoken a little bit about fiber. There are other supplements that minerals or vitamins that we should be aware of that are kind of crucial to migraine, like vitamin D is coming up a lot these days. What are the things that should be on our radar as someone with migraine that perhaps, are wondering whether a deficiency in something or supplementation might be potentially super helpful in managing my migraine condition?
Yeah. So magnesium is one, definitely. Riboflavin, also known as vitamin B2, is another. And then I'll add CoQ10, coenzyme Q10 to that list. And so those are the three that I think we've seen multiple studies to different degrees supporting the use of those supplements in prevention of migraine attacks prospectively. So after people take the supplement for 3 months, seeing reductions in the frequency of their migraines. You mentioned vitamin D. This one is a little newer to the field. So it hasn't received the same kind of what I would say critical review from the migraine research community in the same way magnesium, riboflavin, CoQ10 have all been reviewed by different sort of clinical practice guidelines, and they've sort of survived that gauntlet to still be mentioned. Vitamin D is newer and hasn't gone through kind of the same critical review process since the evidence is more recent. But I will say when I review it, I do think it's very promising. And so that some level of vitamin D supplementation, I expect we may see some recommendations on that moving forward.
And it seems to play a role in a whole bunch of other health components as well, right?
Vitamin D. Yes. Yeah, many different health conditions. Same with magnesium, especially. With the specific forms of magnesium, magnesium oxide, we know, is not well absorbed in the intestinal tract. And so it's actually kind of surprising in some ways that it was effective for migraine, which I think is sort of an intriguing question for science someday. But yeah, so magnesium citrate is more bioavailable than magnesium oxide. Magnesium glycinate is in that category as well of being a little more bioavailable. But I find some people respond differently to different forms. And so when I give recommendations, I generally recommend citrate or glycinate, partly because they're more bioavailable. People tend to tolerate them better, and in terms of affordability as well. The citrate tends to be kind of a happy medium of cost and symptoms.
And when taking supplements, is it a good idea to talk to a healthcare professional about what you're taking, or at least tell your doctor or speak to the pharmacist? Because some of these are not suitable if you're thinking about getting pregnant or if you're breastfeeding.
Yes.
Is that right?
Yeah, I always recommend people you be having conversations with your doctor or your healthcare provider, whoever that is, about the supplements that you're taking. Supplements can interfere with medications, and certain diseases and conditions should not be taking certain supplements. And so it's hard to give blanket advice, and that care really should be personalized to your specific health needs and conditions.
So this one might sound a little bit left field, okay. So go with me on this, but creatine, do you suggest creatine for any of your patients?
The evidence for migraine and creatine is I haven't seen it. What I can say is that there's evidence to show that taking creatine supplements can increase levels of creatine in the brain. And there is some there naturally, produced naturally, but we can increase levels through supplementation. The question is whether that actually translates to outcomes like migraine or brain fog, a symptom of it. I haven't seen the data for that.
One other ingredient, NAD+. Can you tell us what that is and whether we should be sort of paying attention to it?
So NAD+ is another one of those molecules that is involved in the energy metabolism pathway. And so NAD+ as a supplement is attempting to remedy some of that energy deficit in the brain. And but like so many other things, it's got this mechanistic rationale of how it might work, but very little to support that it actually does. So we need more research on that one for sure.
Still very early days. Okay. Yes. So there are so many diets and supplements, it can feel overwhelming. If someone wanted to start improving their diet for migraine, what are some of the first one or two steps that you'd suggest?
So if someone wants to improve their diet for migraine, I think one of the important first steps is to accept that there is no perfect diet for migraine and kind of, let that go from the start. And I think you can set yourself up for success with the understanding that there are things we can do that probably will help you feel better. Some of it may be migraine, some of it may be other things like how your gut feels. But not expecting perfection in either, the foods we eat or in the outcomes. I don't think diet can cure migraine. And I don't think we should be thinking that way, but we can think about how diet can improve how we feel in terms of migraine and more broadly. With that kind of understanding, I would say then the next thing I would recommend is to do some sort of assessment of what you are eating. And this can be even just keeping a food diary for a couple of days, write what you eat. A lot of people with migraine do that already. You could also use an app. Some of the apps will give you sort of nutritional printout of, you know, if you type in what you eat, they'll give you a report of what nutrients it might contain. And so just, and it doesn't have to be a really strict kind of assessment, but just looking, you know, taking stock of how do I eat? And then comparing that against some, you know, maybe if one of the eating patterns we've talked about is appealing, so things like the Mediterranean diet, a low glycemic diet, trying to increase omega-3s, kind of, you know, deciding if any of that makes sense for you. And then trying to find small things, maybe one thing at a time, not changing everything at a time, but looking and saying, you know, I haven't eaten any fish in the past week. You know, that's something, that's my goal for this week. I'm going to try to eat fish twice this week to increase my omega-3 intake from food. What I find is, you know, when we kind of reach out for support, a lot of people are very happy to help and support. And so what I mean by help is, you know, working with family at your house and saying, you know, hey, I want to eat more fish. If I incorporate that into a meal, would you try it? And so if fish just shows up on the table, it might be a surprise. But if people kind of hear, you know, I think this really might help me feel better, that, you know, we can often get more support. So small, you know, accepting that it won't be perfect, making small changes until they're sustainable. And then, you know, trying to enlist help of our friends and loved ones to help support us in making those changes.
I love that tip about, you know, recruiting sort of friends and family to help. I mean, it would make things so much easier if someone is going through the same sort of dietary changes with you at home when their, you know, meals are cooked. What does a balanced, sustainable, migraine-friendly plate look like for most people?
For most people, I would say a balanced, migraine-friendly plate doesn't have to look all that different than what I would recommend for kind of health promotion, disease prevention for a lot of people. With the exception, if somebody has food triggers that they, you know, they really, really have a strong connection when they eat this food, they always get an attack. You know, of course, don't eat that. But in the absence of kind of strong reasons to avoid foods, I think it can be kind of a similar plate for kind of the general public who's looking to promote health and avoid heart disease and so forth. So the plate that I would envision would be a lot of vegetables and fruits, whole grain, and some sort of protein. And that could be beans, nuts, seeds, as you know, would be my picks for kind of the predominant protein sources, sometimes some meat, or maybe a little bit of meat to flavor a dish, could be a way of going about it. But definitely kind of, I like to promote the consumption of the vegetables, the fruits, the whole grains, and kind of other things, fill in the rest.
Many people have tried multiple diets without much lasting success. What would you say to someone who's discouraged or feels like their efforts haven't made a difference?
I'm sorry. First, I would, you know, and recognize that they've put in a lot of work to try different diets. I think what I would encourage them is, they may not have seen success in migraine outcomes, but a lot of these eating patterns that I, at least the ones I promote, also have other health benefits. And so something like increasing omega-3 content is good for long-term cardiovascular health also. A low glycemic diet is good for metabolic health and blood glucose levels. So the efforts they're making to follow one of these diets or multiple diets probably are also increasing nutritional quality of their overall diet, which is impacting their risk for these other conditions, many of which commonly co-occur with migraine. And so it may not be as evident, but hopefully there are some other benefits that they're accruing from different dietary strategies that they've taken. And then the other thing I would say is some of these diets, they can take, a lot of the studies use a 3-month kind of minimum before they start to assess an effect. And that's a long time to try a diet before, you know, feeling better. So kind of just encouraging, if they haven't given it that time, to encourage that, yes, there are these other benefits, and maybe a little more time might help.
Dr. Slavin, it's been a fantastic interview. I'm certainly going to make a few gentle changes to my eating habits. I won't call it a diet. I'll call it eating habits. So it's not something temporary. And you've given me some great tips. And I think a lot of people have gotten some great tips out of this. So thank you so much for joining us again on the Migraine World Summit.
Thank you for having me.